540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. Severe storms on the East Coast wreak havoc on air travel. FlightAware says over 1,800 flights have been canceled and more than 6,100 delayed. CBS's Errol Barnett at Newark Airport.
Thousands have been stranded at Newark Airport, like Christian Weaver. She's been stuck since Saturday, traveling with her diabetic mother, who was down to her last syringe.
I know my mother, and I know how weak she can get if she doesn't have her medicine. She needs this. It's not a one. It's me.
Partly to blame is a series of thunderstorm systems leading to torrential rains and flash flooding across parts of New Jersey and Pennsylvania, with wind gusts up to 70 miles per hour.
A Dallas, Texas water fountain is welcome relief from triple-digit temperatures. Energy expert Doug Lewin says the power grid can withstand the heat.
ERCOT system is much better suited for the summertime than it is for the winter. There have not been summer outages in Texas in over a generation at least.
The Texas heat dome is expected to expand to several states this week. The U.S. Supreme Court sides with North Carolina's Supreme Court and voting rights groups by upholding the oversight function of the state court to rule on election laws and redistricting. Loyola Law School professor Lori Levinson explains that the decision by the U.S. Supreme Court
that actually rejected the independent state legislature theory, which would have allowed North Carolina to draw any kind of lines that they wanted for their election maps, and would have given the Republicans full power without oversight by the state Supreme Court or even the federal courts.
Five deputy sheriffs in Mississippi accused of sexually assaulting two black men and shooting one in the mouth have been fired or resigned.
Michael Jenkins and Eddie Parker say the deputies from the Rankin County Sheriff's Department burst into a home with no warrant, allegedly beat them, sexually assaulted them, and tased them repeatedly in a 90-minute encounter in January. Jenkins says one of them shoved a gun into his mouth and fired the weapon. The Justice Department has opened a civil rights probe into the department. The Rankin County Sheriff announced Tuesday that the deputies had been fired and some had resigned, but refused to give their names or offer additional details. Allison Keys, CBS News.
He starred in films including Room with a View.
He wants you for a possession, something to look at, like a painting or an ivory box.
Now a coroner's office confirms that remains found in a mountainous area near Los Angeles are those of British actor Julian Sands. He was reported missing in January after he had gone hiking. On Wall Street, stocks rallied. The Dow closed up 212 points. NASDAQ closed up 220 points. This is CBS News.
Need to hire quality candidates fast? You need Indeed, the end-to-end hiring solution. Attract, interview, and hire candidates all in one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
News is brought to you by Gingras Thompson & Wachs, a statewide team of personal injury lawyers getting you the justice you deserve. Call 855-954-1186 for a free consultation.
For Civic Media News, I'm Stuart J. Waddles. Here's what you need to know in Southeast Wisconsin. Our specific area is uniquely impacted in the air quality alert. Meteorologist Brittany Merlot has more.
Smoke from wildfires has spread to Waukesha and Milwaukee. An air quality advisory runs through Thursday, reaching a very unhealthy level, purple zone, making it the second worst in the world. The six colored categories range from 0 to 500, and Milwaukee hit a 248. Visibility is down to 1 to 4 miles. As this haze fills the air, even healthy people are experiencing issues. I'm meteorologist Brittany Merlot, Civic Media News.
A nature trail will once again take a backseat to the state fair. The DNR says in a statement the Hank Aaron State Trail will be closed between South 76th Street and South 84th to prioritize safety as it passes directly over State Fair Park. The closure aims to maintain a secure perimeter to the fair. For Civic Media News, I'm Stuart J. Waddles.
The law firm of Gingras Thompson & Wachs has a track record of making life-changing, positive differences for their clients. $5.25 million to a woman who suffered brain injuries and her husband passed away when struck by a drunk driver. $1 million to three different individuals injured by drunk drivers. $1 million settlement to a man injured in a motorcycle accident. Call Gingras Thompson & Wachs, 855-954-1186.
All in to win, Gingras Thompson & Wachs, GTW Lawyers.com.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Gary from Sussex. Hey, Gary.
Whose birthday is it? Is it both you guys' birthday or is it Dom or Mike's?
It's my birthday today. Mike's was 2 days ago.
I'm going to sing a happy birthday, and I'm going to sing it the right way. Happy birthday to you, Mr. President of his radio station and his sidekick.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. The Maggie Dawn Show.
Wisconsin's manner of funding local government is nearly singular in the country. That cheese stands alone, if you will. It hasn't been working in Milwaukee. It hasn't been working in Rhinelander. It hasn't been working in La Crosse, Green Bay, Madison, Kenosha, Racine. I don't care what you pick. It ain't working.
The Maggie Dawn Show, Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
On the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. A little, this is one of those things that just drives me insane. You've got the destroyer senators, you've got people who didn't step up in the moment when they could have come on and said, yeah, we're gonna support infrastructure, we're gonna support rebuilding America, we're gonna take off the red hat and the blue hat, we're gonna get that hard hat on, and we're gonna build stuff. They could have voted for it. They could have gotten behind it. They could have supported it. But they didn't. And there are 30 Republican senators who, when this bipartisan infrastructure bill went through, chose, no, we're not going to support infrastructure spending. We're going to take our ball and go home. Now, it's interesting because this isn't new. But it did catch the ire of the social medias today. It's not new that these people who voted against it, then when the good stuff starts rolling out, when there's a bridge ceremony, where there's a ribbon cutting, or there's a new road that people go, oh my gosh, that road is paved, or you name it, broadband access, let's say. When things start going, hey, that's a good thing, they want to jump right in. They want to jump right to the front and go, hey, this is great, isn't it? Thank goodness we did this. So you got John Cornyn, Texas senator, voted against the bipartisan infrastructure bill. He tweeted out that Texas is receiving $3.3 billion in federal funds to boost broadband expansion. And he links, to this article saying how great this is. Like he was behind it. He wasn't. He voted against it. The dumbest guy in the Senate, Tommy Tuberville, someone who voted against infrastructure improvements, he tweeted out, broadband is vital for the success of our rural communities and for our entire economy. Great to see Alabama receiving crucial funds to boost ongoing broadband efforts. Not that you did anything to help that money come in there, dumbest guy in the Senate, but take credit for it anyway. This is great. It's great. Thank goodness. It's great. And the thing, as I'm seeing this play out, again, not new. This has been going on for a very long time. Our Republican destroyer friends attempting to tear things down. And then once it's being built, They want to jump to the front of the line and go, hey, isn't this great? Look, hey, this is great. Vote for us so we can continue to not do our jobs. And it got me thinking that as I was looking through the list of 30 senators who voted against the infrastructure plan, it's not surprising they come from heavily red states, taker states. And you go through the amount of money, of tax dollars that goes into these places, like Alabama, perfect example. The amount of federal money that goes into Alabama far exceeds what Alabama sends to the federal government. They are a taker state. And these taker senators are doing everything they can do to starve the federal government of resources. And it got me thinking today of going, explain to me why Joe Biden is doing. And now look, I've said this before. Joe Biden is a much better man than I am. He is a much more concerned person about the future of the country, much more compassionate, empathetic, all of that stuff. I am not. I wouldn't give Alabama, if you voted against this, if your senator voted against it, if your senators voted against it, you wouldn't get a red penny, not a freaking dime. Your infrastructure could crumble for all I would care. Biden's better than that. There's a lot of money going to these taker states. And I want to make sure that we understand that the people who are pushing against investments, the people who are pushing against a system of the federal government helping to rebuild the country for the good of the country, for the general welfare of the nation and the nation's economy, I think it's important that you point these people out. Ron Johnson in Wisconsin, another example of this. A guy who has voted against every opportunity to make our country better, a clear destroyer, somehow reelected in Wisconsin. Mind-blowing. And this is one of those moments where you look at the investments that are coming, and there's part of me that's not as good as Joe Biden. It just is. And we've talked about the taker states. We've talked about how they are basically sucking blue states dry. And there's so much more that should be invested in blue states because of this redistribution of wealth. And again, the very people who voted against this are the same people, the same destroyers who want to go after the IRS. Say, no, we're not going to hire new IRS agents because, well, they would go after rich people to bring more money in. Think about this for a second. The people who told us that they care about the deficit, they care about our debt, they're the very people who are doing everything they can do to destroy our ability to go out and get the revenue that is supposed to come in. It's not even talking about new revenue. It's just about enforcing existing laws. Again, our Republican destroyer friends, the law and order people, except when it comes to rich people and their money. It's quite remarkable. Now, President Biden going to be kicking off the big campaign. And look, Biden economics is doing well. The economy is moving in the right direction, creating jobs. Inflation's coming down. And look, you know, Biden's eager to get out there and start, you know, talking about how we've turned things around. He took office. We were not in a good place. Jobs have come back. Investments have happened. We're moving in a good direction. And look, I think it's important for him to go out and make this case. I've said it before. You know, we've got Jelly Bucket Joe, who just shows up and does the work. You know, Builder Joe, Builder Biden out there, you know, doing the work. Not taking credit for much. I think he has to. I think the Democrats have to come out and come out big and say, look, the reality is we've been helping the economy grow. We've been building it from the bottom up, middle out, not top down. That is a good thing. That's going to help working families. And you look at that bridge in Philadelphia, you know, that I-95 bridge that collapsed because of the fire. They pulled all of the resources together. It shows that we can do things, and we can do big things if you just get these destroyers out of the way. You know, I love hearing my Republican friends, well, you know, regulations stop everything. Well, I don't know so much. I don't know so much about regulation. I know Republican senators stop a lot of things because the U.S. Senate is where progress goes to die because of our destroyer senators. Now, as I said, you know, the president is touting his jobs record. In fact, put out a graph today showing that in, during his tenure, he has created more jobs than any of the recent presidents from Reagan forward in 2 years than they did in four. He's created, you know, just under 500,000 jobs a month now on average. Now, immediately the Twitter's, no, these are all those jobs came back. No, those jobs are gone. What happened under Trump's watch, mishandling the pandemic, pretty big freaking deal, cost millions of jobs. Getting them back up took some work. It's just not like flipping a switch and everything goes back to normal. There was a process. Now, this is what I love my right-wing friends for, because they believe the economy is just like, yeah, flip that switch back on, get everything rolling again. We had major supply chain issues, still do, and they're working on those. But the fact that they're talking about reshoring manufacturing and moving away from the old neoliberal kind of policies that got us into this mess is enormous and something we need to get behind. The fact that we're investing in chip manufacturing and investing in renewable energies being done here, important. And the kind of stuff that I got to tell you, I think is going to reap him benefits at the polls because it's wildly popular. They want jobs back in their communities. They want good family sustaining wages and saying, hey, look, we want to make sure that those jobs that are being created are the kind of jobs that people can make a living on is an important part of this. And there's finally a president who talks like that. So for me, this idea that he's going to run on his economic platform, he needs to, because it's a winner. And for all of the rhetoric we're going to hear from the Republicans, they have done nothing to help move in a positive direction. Everything on the Republican side right now, and I hate this. I hate this about where we are. Everything that they have done is to try and slow Biden's economy, to try and cause a recession, to cause chaos, to destroy. That is what they are all about. And I wish it was different. I do. I wish they had an agenda. I wish they would say, look, we control the House. We're going to actually pass something that's going to make the economy better. We're going to pass our own infrastructure bill. We're going to pass our own investment in healthcare or education. We're going to show you how we're going to help an economy. I know, but Rick, they're not that party. They're the party of the invisible hand. They're the party of the invisible man doing invisible things behind an invisible curtain while giving you the invisible finger. That's who they are, and that's where we are when they take control of the economy. Because interestingly enough, in looking at the graphic that Biden put out, it's interesting to see how during Republican administrations, job creation tanks. I mean, tanks. And during Democratic administrations, you build things back up. It kind of goes to show that maybe austerity doesn't work as well. And I know, but Rick, you're talking about an economy that works for working people. That's not what Republicans are in favor of. They want an economy that works for the very wealthy. And that is apparent when you look at all the tax cut bills that they've gotten through, that the only real legislative victory for Donald Trump was a massive tax handout to the very wealthy. When you look at it from the frame of, but Rick, Republicans have an economic agenda. And when they are in control, it works exactly as it's supposed to. It makes the wealthy and big corporations wealthier and more prosperous, and it makes working people poorer. And when Democrats get into office, the agenda is to how do we make them whole? How do we get them jobs? How do we get them the ability to support their families? Again, my more moderate Democrats, but we got to worry about corporate profits too. I'm not so concerned. Corporations will take care of themselves. They do really well at lobbying in their best interests. Not so much yours or mine or working people's. And this is where, you know, that election, those election things matter. So I got to tell you, I'm hoping Joe runs on and highlights hugely, to use a Trump word, how well he has done for our economy. And basically, you know, shove it right up there. Anyway, I'm going to take a quick break. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, podcast. Wherever you get your favorites, you'll find ours. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Quote of the day comes from Liz Cheney, former congresswoman from Wyoming. What we've done in our politics is create a situation where we're electing idiots. Yeah. She's not wrong. Look, I'm not a huge Liz Cheney fan by any stretch of the imagination. That Cheney name, that makes me very, very cautious. But she's not wrong. We are electing idiots. You look at the dog and pony show going on in the House, the bread and circus nonsense that they're pulling. Liz, you're right. And you look at the Republicans, the person who's probably going to be their nominee for president, went on Twitter today to lose his mind. That social thing he's got, that Truth Social. That he truthed today. Could somebody please explain to the deranged, Trump-hating Jack Smith, his family and his friends, that as president of the United States, I come under the Presidential Records Act, as affirmed by the Clinton Sox case, not by this psycho's fantasy of the never used before Espionage Act of 1917. Smith, in quotation marks, not sure why it's in quotation marks, should be looking at crooked Joe Biden with two D's and all of his crimes that he has perpetrated on the American public, including the millions and millions of dollars he extorted from foreign countries. I think he should worry about his own legal troubles first, but let's deconstruct this a bit. Outside of the fact that he misspelled Biden's name, and I think he did that on purpose because he's that kind of punitive child. But you know, the misspelling and the use of the hyphen in psychos, go back to school, learn a little something. But the open threat, and I take that as an open threat, you know, would somebody please explain to the deranged Trump-hating Jack Smith, his family and his friends? What? Because what this is, for those who don't know, this is code. Hey, crazy people. Hey, dim. Hey, poorly educated. Go find Jack Smith's house. Go knock on his door. Go harass his children. Go harass his wife. Go after his friends. Intimidate them. Because this is what they know. They know this works. Look what they did to Peter Hotez. They literally sent people to his house because he won't debate a lunatic. This is the kind of dog whistle. And this isn't even a dog whistle. This is like almost an outward command. Hey, crazy people, go harass Jack Smith. This is the kind of stuff that they do. This is what fascist dictators do. This is the kind of stuff that authoritarians do. And the weird thing is the Trump folk, they don't care because that's their mindset. And as I've said before, there are those, the fives that you're never going to get. You don't even bother talking to them because you're never going to reach them. Like this guy from this, there's this, I'm not even going to say the name of it. It's one of these right-wing outlets that, you know, is trying to be extreme beyond the extreme. They're trying to be MAGA ultra. And one of their correspondents, there's a video going around on social media. One of their correspondents said, look, we don't give a damn what the recordings say. Nope, I don't care what the recording says. You could bring out 100 other recordings. What I know is Trump put America first. So you can't talk to these folks. And these aren't journalists. These are propagandists. What they're saying is it doesn't matter. Facts don't matter. Reality doesn't matter. Our dear leader needs us. Our dear leader, the one who is in real trouble. I don't know if you heard the tape, but the tape is pretty clear. The perfect tape. We have the perfect phone call now, and a couple of phone calls, actually. And now this perfect tape of him admitting, outwardly, very clearly admitting. One of the Watergate historians had a great quote. He said, you know, there are thousands of hours of Nixon, you know, and in none of those moments is Nixon as clear about the illegal actions that he was doing as Trump was. Trump was right. I know I shouldn't be showing you this, but look what I got. Oh boy. It's quite remarkable when you stop and think about it. And the fact that they're even trying to make this, I'm under different laws. I'm special. I don't think it's going to fly in court, and we'll see. We will see. Now, if that isn't enough to give Donald Trump heartburn, Jack Smith, who evidently is now living in between Trump's ears, evidently he's set to interview Brad Raffensperger. And you know who Brad Raffensperger is? He's the Secretary of State of Georgia. He's the guy on the perfect phone call. I remember Donald Trump called him and said, hey, I need 11,000 some odd votes. You know, go find those. You know, find a couch somewhere, dig your hand down into the cushions, and grab me 11,000. He said, I won by 400,000, but I just need 11,000. So go find those. He is going to be interviewed by Jack Smith on all of the stuff. And my mind goes, you know, why is it taking this long to get to him? And I know Jack Smith is now, I guess, setting up to talk to Rudy. So the walls, there was an 80s song, but I think it was The Call. The walls come tumbling down. The walls are tumbling down. But interestingly enough, the Republican Party is doing everything they can do to put themselves right in the heart of it. You have Kevin McCarthy, who is now, and this is bizarre to me, and I don't know how you do this, but they're attempting to rewrite history. They're going to go back and try and expunge Trump of the impeachments. And I'm going, I don't know how you do that. I don't know how you go back and, you know, we're just going to rewrite all this history. And it never happened. Never happened. It'll be in a sealed box somewhere. History will never remember this. I'm thinking about, you know, history as a whole. Yeah, I'm kind of thinking that, you know, maybe we could just, you know, rewrite everything, because this seems to be how Republicans act. And as I'm reading through this potential expungement of impeachment, I'm thinking about, you know, the book, you know, 1984 that I had to read in 10th grade. And I'm thinking about Winston Smith, and I'm going, man, Orwell, how did you know? What crystal ball did George Orwell have to be able to predict a presidency, you know, decades later? But they're in the process of considering this. I don't know how you do this, but they're going to try. And they're going to try and defend Dear Leader, and they're going to try and rewrite what happened in the past while simultaneously going forward and impeaching Joe Biden. Now, they don't know for what yet. They've got articles of impeachment, not sure what they are yet. But, you know, much like all of the Rudy Giuliani at the Four Seasons landscaping facility making up a bunch of stuff, they're still not going in front of the people with robes, still not putting their hand on that Bible and swearing to tell the truth. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1905. That was the day over 200 socialists, anarchists, and Marxists representing over 40 organizations met at Brands Hall in Chicago to convene the founding of the Industrial Workers of the World. Representatives from groups like the Socialist Party, Socialist Labor Party, and Western Federation of Miners joined together for an 11-day convention to discuss the future of industrial unionism and revolutionary struggle. Those present included Big Bill Haywood, James Connolly, Daniel De Leon, Eugene V. Debs, Lucy Gonzalez Parsons, Mother Jones, and many more. They hoped to cohere an alternative to the politically conservative business unionism of the American Federation of Labor. They sought to build on the legacy of the Knights of Labor and their motto of "an injury to one is an injury to all." They were determined to build an industrial union that organized workers regardless of skill level. They also distinguished themselves by opening their doors to men and women, black, white, and all immigrant workers, including Asians. Big Bill Haywood opened the first day's morning session with the following remarks, saying, quote, "This is the Continental Congress of the Working Class. We are here to confederate the workers of this country into a working class movement that shall have as its purpose the emancipation of the working class from the slave bondage of capitalism. There is no organization that has for its purpose the same object as that for which you are called together today. The aims and objects of this organization should be to put the working class in possession of the economic power, the means of life, in control of the machinery of production and distribution without regard to capitalist masters." For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
When you think of Americans whose music has made a lasting difference, you might think of Scott Joplin, Woody Guthrie, Maybelle Carter, Harry Belafonte, or Roger Payne. Who? I came across Payne in a June obituary reporting that he had died at age 88. Yes, I occasionally scan the obits, not out of morbid curiosity, but because these little death notices encompass our people's history, reconnecting us to common lives that had some small or surprisingly large impact. Payne's impact is still reverberating around the globe, even though few know his name. A biologist who studied moths in the 1960s, he chanced upon a technical military recording of undersea sounds that incidentally included a cacophony of baying, shrieking, squealing, and caterwauling. They were the voices of humpback whales. What others had considered noise blew my mind, said Payne, describing them as a musical chorus of exuberant, uninterrupted rivers of sound. His life's work shifted from moths to whales, then to the interdependence of all species. At the time, whales were treated by industry and governments as dull, lumbering nuisances. But Payne's musical instincts came into play, sensing that the singing of these magnificent mammals might reach the primordial soul of humans. So he collected their rhythmic, haunting melodies into a momentous 1970 recording titled Songs of a Humpback Whale. It became a huge bestseller, altered public perception, and spawned a global Save the Whales campaign, one of the most successful conservation movements ever. This is Jim Hightower saying, so without writing or performing a single musical note, this scientist produced a truly powerful serenade from nature that continues to make a difference. To connect with Roger Payne's musical work and help extend his deep understanding that all of us beings are related, contact Ocean Alliance at whale.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So big news coming out of the Supreme Court today. And I got to tell you, shocker, shocker. 6-3 decision. Again, did I mention shocker? Because, you know, months ago I said, you know, I think it's going to be a sad day when this Moore decision comes down, because I had really thought that these six conservative justices are going to go, no. Let's do the craziest possible thing we can do on election law and give it to crazy people to do whatever they want. I'm shocked. There are only three people who thought that on the court. Clarence Thomas, Judge Alito, and Judge Gorsuch. Are you surprised Alito and Thomas? You're surprised Gorsuch. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on what this means and what this independent legislature doctrine could have been or would have been, and fortunately now is dead. I've asked Kathy Fang to come talk with us. Kathy's the president of programs at Common Cause. CommonCause.org is their website. Kathy, thanks for taking time for us.
Absolutely. So excited to be here.
So this is kind of a, let's use a Bidenism. This is a big freaking deal.
This is a huge deal, to use the words of other people. I will say that I think that when the case first came up, we certainly felt nervous, because just the way that it was framed as if it was looking at whether courts at the state level could go rogue, right? Are there any kind of bounds on state courts? But once we got before the Supreme Court, and let me be clear, there were some 45 plus amicus briefs on our side compared to a very paltry 10 or so on the other side, that basically urged the court to look at this theory, the independent state legislature theory, as something that was a very dangerous threat to our democracy. And those amicus briefs came from the left and the right, from people who are, you know, friends like at ADL, as well as people who are founding fathers of the Federalist Society, right? So people on the, you know, on all sides of the political spectrum who are urging the Supreme Court to say, this case is such a potential dangerous threat to our democracy. It would unwind what we know and think of as the fundamental checks and balances in American government, right? The very thing that ensures that one branch doesn't go rogue, we don't have dictators, we don't have political coups, we don't have lawless lawmakers, because we've got this system of checks and balances built in. And I think once the Supreme Court heard those arguments, read the amicus briefs, and really thought about what was at stake, it was right that six of the Supreme Court justices said, hell no, we cannot allow one branch of government to be absolutely and without any restriction able to exercise power when it comes to federal elections. That's just a no-go, because once we go there, then you are giving them the power to stay in office forever, to be able to shape and punish shape laws that punish dissent, right? We go down the road of the Politburo. Right. And I think that the Supreme Court was right to reject that crazy theory.
I mean, but dangerous threat to democracy sounds right up the row of where these guys are. Because look, I've been saying for a while that you've got people like the Federalist Society, you've got all these think tanks, you've got all this money going into these organizations to dream up the worst ideas possible. And this independent legislature doctrine, one of those bad ideas coming out of those think tanks. Again, there are a lot of these bad ideas. So I'm looking at this originally going, you know, I'm kind of concerned, because this stuff generally goes slipping right through.
Yeah.
But I'm glad it didn't. So the question that I have is, you know, because I had a listener ask me the other day, you know, there have been a couple of voting kind of things coming out of the Supreme Court lately. Has the Supreme Court, or at least three of the conservative justices, had an about face, had a change of heart? Are we seeing a switch in time to save nine kind of scenario?
Yeah.
Where are we?
I think that only time will tell. Right. We don't know whether this is a change that is a turning of a corner when it comes to the fundamental democratic principles that our country is based on. But what I like to believe is that it didn't take a lot for them to look at what's written in our U.S. Constitution, what's passed by Congress as federal laws like the Voting Rights Act, what's written in state constitutions to say, all right, while we may disagree ideologically on where to fall on many, many issues, there are some foundational stones that our country is based on. And if we start dismantling those things, we are, what, cutting off our nose to spite our face, right? I think just for that temporary political win, you will end up dismantling the very country that you think you are trying to gain power in. And so I think that the Supreme Court realized that in order to interpret history, precedent, the language of the Constitution correctly, what it had to do was take a step back from all of the political craziness, right? And I think that what they've seen is how far it will go. When you watch people storming Congress, right, with the flag as a battering ram, you realize that this is not a game anymore. You can't say yes to this kind of crazy idea and not expect that what you potentially are doing is opening it up to a total dismantling,
right,
of our country. And I think that in a lot of ways, this is the Supreme Court realizing they cannot go that far. And in the end, they are institutionalists, right? They want to preserve certain things. And I think that it's right that three justices who normally identify as on the right side of the column, right, conservative, would side with the liberal justices, because this is no longer about whether you are a Democrat or a Republican. This is about whether you're an American. And if you start dismantling those fundamental ideals that we have, you know, the thing that we all grew up learning in Schoolhouse Rock, right? There are three branches of government. Right. You need one that checks the other, right? Before you can pass a law, you know, the whole, what is a bill, right? And I really think that there was a revisit of what does this country stand for? And we cannot let that slide into an abyss simply for temporary political gain by one party.
Listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Kathy Fang. Kathy's the Vice President of Programs at Common Cause, commoncause.org, the website, if you want to check out the work that they do and more information on this. So now this independent legislature doctrine,
yes,
it's now dead. So we don't even really have to go into how bad it would have been. It's now dead. My question now becomes, okay, this is now dead. What is the next bad idea? Because they never seem to stop. There's always something next. There's always, you know, more legislative action to put roadblocks between voters and the ballot box. There's always Texas trying to overturn elections that they don't like. There's always these things. What do you see as next?
Well, let's remember that the Supreme Court has dealt us quite a few blows when it comes to the kinds of protections that we have seen in the laws. Okay, so recently, with the Voting Rights Act, we were all thrilled to death that the court left intact what's called Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act that says you cannot dilute minority votes, whether that's through the passage of restrictive voting laws or redistricting, right? But they did dismantle in an earlier case in Shelby County versus Holder in 2013, the protections against those kinds of very bad laws that would allow people to come into court and seek a protective order to prevent those bad laws from going into effect so that you can run an election on a free and clean process without having to allow that bad law to go into effect. Now what has to happen is you allow the law to go into effect, you allow the bad effects to happen, and then you go to court, and which does take time, right? So that could be one election cycles or a couple of election cycles running under gerrymandered laws or restrictive voting laws. Those kinds of things still exist. And so what we may see is, and we continue to see, is number one, states pushing restrictive voting laws that take away the ability for people to access the ballot, to register to vote, to cast a ballot, by putting a million hurdles in front of them. The second thing that we're seeing is a real attempt by state legislatures to claw back the right of people to use the initiative process to protect rights, right? And so in Ohio and Florida and many other states, there is an effort to try to up the requirement to pass a ballot initiative from 50% or 55% to 60% or 65%, right? So just keep raising the bar so it becomes harder and harder to do things like create independent redistricting commissions or protect reproductive rights or protect other kinds of rights that the majority or the supermajority of voters want, but now we're going to make it super, super hard for people to be able to pass those laws in states that have the initiative process. Now, not all states have that process. Right. And so the last way that people had to protect their rights was to go to their state courts, right? And so the good news is that the Supreme Court has said, okay, we're not going to blow up that bridge. That path still exists for you. If you need to, that is a bridge that you can go to seek justice from the state court. Thank goodness, right? Because had they done that, that would have left half of the country without any redress when it comes to violations of their voting rights, violations of individual rights, right? When it comes to thinking about elections. So I think that the court has started to pull away. I hope they've turned the ship in a different direction, and they're starting to move towards understanding that there are some basic fundamental voting rights that cannot be eroded any further. And I think that the events that have happened recently, whether you want to think about the coup, that the attempted coup, you know, that happened on January 6th, or frankly, Supreme Court justices, you know, being found out to have accepted essentially bribes, yeah, right, in office, I have to think that Chief Justice Roberts is looking at that and saying, that goes too far.
Yeah, no, I've been asking for a while.
I can't side with that anymore.
Yeah, I've been asking for a while, at what point does Roberts start thinking about his legacy and what yeah, the history of the Roberts Court is going to be? Is it going to be billionaires having pet justices and, you know, maybe NASCAR robes? I don't know, but I got to believe he's thinking about that. And I got to think,
I think he is. And does he want to be associated with people who are going to be found guilty of violating not just ethical rules, but laws, criminal laws, right? And I think that we've got a situation where a couple of the justices on the conservative side have gotten themselves very much caught in a pay-to-play kind of system. And I think on the other side, you have a group of justices, and I like to think that Ketanji Brown Jackson is a breath of fresh air. And perhaps Chief Justice Roberts is saying, you know what, maybe I need to rethink where I stand, because I want to stand on the side of right and justice and good, right?
Well, I wish I had your optimism.
I believe it. I believe it. And I believe that one day we're going to see photos of Chief Justice Roberts and perhaps Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson sitting on an elephant together, you know, exchanging good ideas, traveling the world, but expanding their minds, right? And really thinking about the world in a broader, with a broader view. And I think that that is possible now that we are seeing that Justice Amy Coney Barrett, Brett Kavanaugh, and Chief Justice Roberts are voting in a way that I think is much more thoughtful, right? And they're not just voting in lockstep with a certain ideological bent, the way that some people who have proven themselves to be bought and paid for, yeah, by special interests are doing.
So I guess we'll find out, won't we? I mean, because there are still some big cases to come yet.
There are some big cases. And I'm not saying that they've necessarily changed their ideology entirely. But I think when it comes to these types of cases that are fundamentally about rights that are enshrined in law and in the Constitution, I think that there has to be a line drawn that says, we're not going to dismantle things that are written in law things that are written in the Constitution, things that we've been practicing for 250 years or more, right, in the United States.
Well, either way, it is a good day for democracy. I'll take the win, or at least I'll take what, you know, this shouldn't have been even on the table. Again, it's one of those things I don't even know why they took, but I'm glad this time they're on the right side of history, and we'll see where things go. But as the horrible continues, I'd love to have you come back and share some thoughts. I appreciate the time.
Every once in a while, we have a little sunshine in July. It's a good way to go into July 4th to celebrate the things that we know America actually stands for. And that is freedom and democracy for all people, and not a cramped view of what those rights mean. And I think today the Supreme Court gave us something to celebrate.
I'm there with you. Kathy, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Kathy Fang, she is the Vice President of Programs at Common Cause. Make sure you check out their website, commoncause.org. We'll get links out on social media. But take a quick break, right back. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1880. That was the day that Helen Keller was born in Tuscumbia, Alabama. 2 years later, she lost both her sight and hearing due to an illness. With the help of a teacher by the name of Ann Sullivan, Helen learned how to communicate again. Her inspiring story was retold in the play and movie, The Miracle Workers. Keller spent the rest of her life advocating for people with disabilities, as well as a woman's right to vote and a woman's right to birth control. But did you know she was also an outspoken supporter of the cause of labor? Helen was a socialist and a member of the Industrial Workers of the World Union. In 1912, Helen sent a check to support textile workers on strike in Little Falls, New York. She accompanied the check with a letter that captured her commitment to the labor movement. She wrote of the women out on strike, quote, "Their cause is my cause. If they are denied a living wage, I also am denied. While they are industrial slaves, I cannot be free. My hunger is not satisfied while they are unfed. I cannot enjoy the good things of life which have come to me if they are hindered and neglected. I want all the workers of the world to have sufficient money to provide the normal standard of living. A decent home, healthful surroundings, opportunity for education and recreation. I want them all to have the same blessings I have. I, deaf and blind, have been helped to overcome many obstacles. I want them to be helped generously in a struggle which resembles my own in many ways." Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Interesting story over at the newspaper of the investor class, the Wall Street Journal. It's amazing how they do this pitch of, you know, you should want to work till you die. You know, you should want to work from the day you're born to the day you die. And they point out in this article that people over 80 are working more. In fact, they're pointing out that they're the largest growing segment of their age group. Is the only group growing in labor participation. Everybody else is lazy. All of the younger groups are actually falling in labor participation. But the 80-year-olds, the octogenarians, they're growing. There's more of them in the workforce. In fact, they point out that about 650,000 people over 80 were in the workforce last year. They're saying that's about 18% more than just 10 years ago. So people are living longer, evidently. This is the frame. People are living longer. They get bored in retirement. There's only so much golf you can do. There's only so much puttering around the house. They want jobs. They want to go to work. And look, there are some people. Look, if they trot out a bunch of names. They trotted out Harrison Ford, I guess, is over 80. They trotted out, Jane Goodall, some CEOs. You know what they didn't trot out? The bricklayer, the truck driver, the people who have to work to make ends meet. Didn't talk about them. And this, what this really is about, and it's a good puff piece. It's a good PR piece. It's like when they find an 80-year-old guy who's got to be a greeter at Walmart because he needs to make money to pay for his prescriptions or for his supplement to Medicare or whatever, just to make ends meet because his retirement hasn't kept up with inflation. They always make it this wonderful puff. Isn't that wonderful? He's working. Oh, that's great. Look at him out there. Yeah. Look, I'm all in favor of people who want to work and don't need to and because it's what gets them blood flow and all that. That's great. But I got to think, of the 650,000 people over 80 who are working, the story is not, oh, I'm bored. I'm not thinking that's it. I'm thinking, I didn't think I was going to live this long. And I didn't save enough, and now I've run out of money, and now I got to go back to work to be able to pay for the prescription drugs that have kept me alive this long. Because, again, we've got Republicans in Congress who will do nothing on prescription drugs. Because we're Americans. We pay full price. But this is another one of these moments where you go, they're pushing this idea that, these people want to work longer. And you know what's coming next. The next sentence, the next puff piece is, Americans, they're putting off Social Security. They're voluntarily putting off Social Security until they're, whatever. So it makes it easier for them to raise the Social Security age. So it makes it, people want to work longer. We're just giving the people what they want, which is insane. Because here's what we know. Social Security's got some problems. By, 2033, I think it is. They're going to have to start cutting back on benefits because we're going to start dwindling down on money. And the reason that we're dwindling down on money is not because baby boomers are retiring or people are taking advantage of the program that they've paid into. No, it's not that at all. It's the fact that there's not enough money. It's the fact that we've had a massive redistribution of wealth over the last 40 years. When Reagan did the whole, we're going to raise Social Security taxes enormously, 6.2% on workers and employers, because how was it framed? We've got to get the pig through the python, because the baby boom generation was so large that we had to put money aside. So that you had to get the pig through the python. So we had to have this massive influx of cash to go into the program. And they did. What they didn't plan on, and this is the problem with where Social Security has a problem. Two things. We've got a cap on it, so rich people only pay so much. I think the cap's like $160,000. So if you make 20 gazillion dollars, if that's earned income, like going to work, you're only paying out 160 grand, where someone who makes 100 grand a year pays every dime of their earnings into Social Security. That's a problem. We could scrap the cap, solve our problem just like that. The other problem, and the bigger problem, is the fact that in the 80s, a much larger share of wealth went to working people. You had much stronger unions. Wages were much higher for working people. They were. And you didn't have this all-out assault that happened Reagan forward on people's ability to get better wages, hours, and conditions. So as your wages have stagnated over these 40 years, you're not paying as much into Social Security. So back in the 80s, when the actuaries figured out how this was going to work, they had assumed that, Reaganomics wasn't going to destroy the working class of this country. And they assumed that wages would continue to keep up as they had been, and taxes coming in, both in the federal coffers and into Social Security, would actually keep up. We wouldn't have a problem with any of this stuff if it weren't for Republicans destroying the ability of workers to get better wages, hours, and conditions by going after unions. Wouldn't have this problem. If we had 25% union density like we had back in the 80s or 35% like we had back in the 60s, people would be making more money. You'd have more money coming into your paycheck, and you would, yes, be paying higher tax, more tax to the government for, you know, funding education and roads and bridges and all kinds of stuff. And we wouldn't have these massive deficits. And also, Social Security would be flush with cash. That's something that, you know, we never really focus on, the massive amount of inequality that's happened in this country because of Republican tax ideology, the tax fetish of.
You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.